On this episode of Skeptico, near-death experience skeptic, Dr. Kevin Nelson.
Then you ask, how can we have experiences with a flat EEG? My question to you is, that's an extraordinary claim. Where is the data that says the experience that they later remembered actually happened at the time the EEG was flat?
Penny Sartori's research, where she went and interviewed people about their resuscitation process and found that people who have a near-death experience are much more accurate in reporting the specific events that go on during resuscitation, is a pretty good, solid research that backs up what so many of the near-death experiencers say, which is that this was...
Her data.
Well, that's data. I mean, if you ask people...
No, what is her data?
Her data is that they're statistically significantly more likely to recount the...
Now that's her conclusion. What's her data?
Her data is the number of events in the resuscitation process that they're able to recall. That's the data.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and on this episode of Skeptico, I'm going to dig into the near-death experience research a little bit further. It's just fascinating to me. Every time I turn over a new stone, it gets more and more interesting. And the stone I was looking to turn over today came about when I was Googling near-death experience research, and what pops up over and over again in the most popular mainstream science-y kind of publications like CNN Health or CBS Science News, those kind of things, Time Magazine, these folks that just kind of touch on this, what pops up over and over again is some research that was done a couple years ago by this guy at the University of Kentucky named Kevin Nelson, and you're going to hear from him today. And the way CNN summed up his research is as follows. Nelson thinks that near-death experiences are a part of the dream mechanism and that the person having the experience is in a REM, rapid eye movement state. And I think that's a pretty good summary of what he's saying, although you'll hear him really back off from any kind of reference to dream or dreamlike, which I don't exactly know why he was so unwilling to go there. But we had quite an exchange, if you will. It got a little testy at times, but hey, I really appreciate the guy coming on the show and engaging in the dialogue. I think that's awesome to be able to have this kind of sometimes uncomfortable dialogue about things we disagree with, and he was certainly willing to engage. I think you'll enjoy it. Here is Dr. Kevin Nelson from the University of Kentucky, near-death experience skeptic. We're joined today by Dr. Kevin Nelson, professor of neurology at the University of Kentucky, where he's also director of medical affairs and assistant dean of clinical affairs. Dr. Nelson, thanks so much for joining us today on Skeptico.
My pleasure.
Well, you know, the title from CNN that caught my attention was, Doctor Says Near-Death Experiences Are in the Mind. Well, since that doctor they're referring to is you, I thought we would we'd try and connect with you and hear a little bit more about your research and your findings on this.
Sure. I think near-death experiences are in the brain, and I think that the only experience we can really know about comes from the brain. And so I think that my emphasis as a neurologist, of course, is just that. It's the brain.
I guess that's a great point to start, and what really kind of caught my attention. It seems to me that where most researchers are coming from is that this research, near-death experience research, just screams out that not everything in our mind is in our brain, and that somehow, in some way that we don't understand, consciousness seems to survive death. Why are you so convinced otherwise?
I think that it's actually, you have to look at the burden of proof. The burden of proof is on the individuals that are making the extraordinary claims. The idea that one has consciousness and therefore experiences independent of the brain is a matter of faith. It's not a matter of science. And heretofore, there has been no convincing evidence to indicate, to back up these extraordinary claims that consciousness can exist outside of the brain.
Isn't it all an assumption? Aren't we assuming that since we don't really understand the nature of consciousness and it's something we're just starting to unravel, we don't understand when consciousness begins. We don't understand what biological or non-biological entities are conscious. Aren't we all kind of dancing in the dark here? Why is there some extraordinary burden of proof when someone makes the claim that the evidence seems to suggest, as the evidence in near-death experience does, that consciousness somehow, in some way we don't understand without applying any kind of spiritual ontology to it, but somehow it seems to survive the functioning of the brain? I mean, I don't know how you get away from the data surrounding that. What is your data that kind of drives you in the other direction?
Well, let me ask you, I don't accept your assumption that we don't understand much about the brain and consciousness. In fact, we know a tremendous amount about the brain and how it brings around about consciousness. So I think you really have to ask.
Well, then go back and let's ask those fundamental questions. When does consciousness start?
When does consciousness start?
When does it begin? Does it begin at conception, at birth, 9 months old, 2 months old?
Consciousness, actually, in humans, the conscious states probably begin during gestation, during brain development. In fact, during gestation, the brain spends most of its time in the REM state of consciousness, or certainly that state that becomes, as we get older, REM consciousness. So I think, you know, the idea that we don't understand everything about consciousness means that we don't understand anything about consciousness is a fallacy. We understand a great deal of consciousness. And I really think we have to hit back that people who make extraordinary claims that we can be conscious without our brains need to have extraordinary data to support
them. But Dr. Nelson, that is...
The burden of proof is on the person making the extraordinary claim.
Dr. Nelson, I think that's a very unscientific statement. Whenever we start saying that someone has an extraordinary claim or someone needs to offer extraordinary proof, that gets outside the realm of science in that we're subjectively saying what extraordinary is. I'd suggest to you that given the body of research in near-death experience, the claims that you're making are extraordinary. It's extraordinary to claim that the REM sleep state is somehow connected or explains the near-death experience. I mean, this whole idea of extraordinary claims thing gets a little bit silly when whoever is claiming the other person's claims are extraordinary, it really is trying to shift the burden of proof over on the other person.
Well, what evidence is there?
Well,
beyond the brain.
You know, taking a step back and...
What evidence is there?
I was just going to offer you, you know, if you just look at the evidence in near-death experience, one of the research findings that I guess I wanted to ask you about is it seems like most researchers are finding that the closer someone is to death, the more likely they are to have a near-death experience. Doesn't this kind of fly in the face of your research that suggests that it's somehow like a sleep-mediated state?
How does it do that?
How does what?
That doesn't follow.
It doesn't follow that as someone...
Well, what's the evidence? I'm asking you, what evidence do you want me to address scientifically that indicates that there's experience outside the brain?
Well, I think all...
What evidence...
Okay, what do you make of the Pin von Lommel study in The Lancet that his conclusion is that the most parsimonious conclusion for the near-death experience is that consciousness somehow seems to happen outside or after there is an end to what we normally call, you know, clinical death?
That is a claim. That is not evidence.
Well,
in fact, let's back up. Okay. How does he define clinical death there? What's to him clinical death?
Well, I think when you're working the cardiac arrest ward and you have a flat EEG and a flat EKG.
You don't have a flat EEG. It's a flat ECG.
Well, there's plenty of cases where there's a flat EEG. There's plenty of near-death experience cases where the person is being monitored, they're under anesthesia, and they have a flat EEG, and they are resuscitated from that and have verifiable data that they bring back during their resuscitation. I mean, that's are you not accepting of the basic claim of the near-death experience then?
No. That's not the claim of near-death experience.
But are you down with that?
Let me answer your question. First off, you didn't provide any data. You provided a claim that happened to be made in Lancet, okay? And it has to deal with cardiac arrest, not brain arrest. Then you ask, how can we have experiences with a flat EEG? My question to you is, that's an extraordinary claim. Now, where is the data that says the experience that they later remembered actually happened at the time the EEG was flat? There's no marker that says the person's having the near-death experience now when the EEG is flat.
Okay, I'm gonna.
You don't know what their experience is when the EEG is flat.
Well, hold on.
You don't know when you're monitoring them when they're having the near-death experience. Now, I have spent thousands of hours monitoring people in the operating room, and I've had extensive personal and professional experience on this. And the idea that someone can say, well, at some time in the course of all this, they had a flat EEG and they had a near-death experience doesn't mean that the near-death experience happened during the flat EEG.
Well, I think the best evidence we have of that, first of all, let me back up and say, let me try and get out of the adversarial part. And really, I just want to hear what you say and give you a chance to kind of present your data. And you kind of keep coming back to me and saying, where's the data? Where's the proof? Now, having said that, I have to back up and say, you know, when we publish, when somebody publishes in The Lancet and a long-term study, I think that's more than a claim. I mean, that's science. That's all we have. You are making claims by publishing. That's great. I think you have a biological explanation of near-death experience. I think that's wonderful that that's explored to the fullest extent. I don't quite understand why Pin Van Lommel's claim in The Lancet is any different than any claim that you would make in any of your papers. Maybe let's start there. What did you mean when you said that's just a claim, that's not proof, or that's not evidence?
Well, that was a conclusion that he made after he interviewed people. Okay.
But isn't that all scientists are doing?
Let me back up here, okay? Let me tell you the fundamental difference, okay? Is exactly what you got confused earlier. And that is, clinical death was a flat ECG. See, now you read that as an EEG. And you know what? I did the first time, too. But when I go back and I look at that, I go, no, he's talking about clinical death is a flat ECG. And frankly, and what I'm going to do is I'm going to write Lancet. I was stunned that in a prestigious peer-reviewed article that you could refer to clinical death and then slip and slide about clinical death using the heart stopping as the cause, you know, as the definition of death. Now, we know, I mean, this is like neuroscience 101. You know, this is so incredibly basic. When the heart stops, the brain keeps going. It keeps going for several seconds. And a lot of the times when the heart, have you ever seen anybody's heart stop? Have you ever been in the presence of a time when someone is in cardiac arrest or near cardiac arrest?
Obviously, no.
It's chaos. It's freaking chaos. Okay. Now, what I'm telling you is that the heart stopping, the brain goes for another 10 to 20 seconds just fine. It doesn't become flat-like at that point. It actually develops another kinds of waveforms. It eventually becomes flat. There's no doubt about that. But the most sensitive structure in the brain when the blood stops flowing to it is memory. And so we start, our memories become very discombobulated when the blood flow starts. But the brain does fine for the first 10 to 20 seconds. And the reason it's so dependent on the blood is because it cannot extract energy from stored sources. All of its energy is a very highly energetically demanding organ.
I don't think anyone's making the claim that when somebody has a cardiac arrest, they immediately have a flat EEG. What I've always heard, what I've always heard is exactly what you're saying, that within 10 to 15 seconds of cardiac arrest, there's no brain activity that's measurable by any means that we have. And I think that's what makes the near-death experience hard to explain. I'll just throw out some other research. Throw out some other research and get you to respond to it.
No, I want to respond to your other point, because the reason is you're going under an assumption that, frankly, is a very common misconception. Oftentimes with cardiac arrest, the blood flow isn't zero. A lot of times there is a very low but sustainable blood flow to the brain. And the brain can go in and out of consciousness. And the brain can be conscious even when people around them don't know that it's conscious. That's one of the interesting things about Sanjay Gupta's work, is that the brain can be functioning when people around them don't know about it. Oftentimes in cardiac arrest, it's not a complete rest, it's not a complete loss of blood to the brain. A lot of it's just poor flow to the brain, sluggish blood flow.
Right. I'm sure that's sometimes the case. But I think there's plenty of cases where people are monitored by EEG, by EKG, and by other means, and they still report the near-death experience in... it's kind of like pulling apart.
Well, when did their near-death experience happen?
Well, I think, Penny Sartori's research, where she went and interviewed people about their resuscitation process and found that people who have a near-death experience are much more accurate in reporting the specific events that go on during resuscitation, is a pretty good, solid research that backs up what so many of the near-death experiencers say, which is that this was...
Her data.
Well, that's data. I mean, if you ask people...
No, what is her data?
Her data is that they're statistically significantly more likely to recount the...
Now, that's her conclusion. What's her data?
Her data is the number of events in the resuscitation process that they're able to recall. That's the data.
Now, what was their medical condition during the time they recalled it?
Well, they were being resuscitated, so,
that doesn't mean
cardiac...
that they don't have any blood flow to the brain. That's why they're being resuscitated. They're pumping blood to their brain during resuscitation. They're not dead. They're in crisis. They may be dead if you don't do something, but their brain ain't dead at that time.
So that would be your explanation for them being conscious of their resuscitation process.
Yeah, of course.
And for them...
They're not moving.
For them,
they're paralyzed.
And for them having an out-of-body experience and being able to see events that are happening both inside the room and outside the room.
They put that together, the events outside the room. Remember what I said? The memory is the structure of the brain, the hippocampus, that's most sensitive to lack of blood flow. It's the first thing injured, and it's the last thing to recovery. So these memories get all scrambled up, and you can't remember if it's something that you heard about going on in the room, that's during a moment of conversation that someone had that you incorporated into your memory as having actually experienced it. You know, so all these sensations and memories are getting scrambled.
Right. So why is the group that had the near-death experience, why are their memories more accurate, you suppose, than the group that didn't have the near-death experience? So all these people got resuscitated, right? That's her study, right? Let's take all these people that were resuscitated. Let's take the group that claims they had an...
Do you ever hear about the story that their memories are inaccurate? No, you don't hear those.
Well, we're talking about this piece of research. I'd like to know What's your hypothesis for explaining away why the group that had the near-death experience was more accurate in recounting the resuscitation process? I mean, you just offered up. Well, you just offered
they
up
had
an
better blood flow to the brain.
But why would they be more likely?
They had better blood flow to the brain. Two.
Why did they have more?
Their memory circuits were being activated and driven by the fight or flight response, and they were had a higher, more higher drive to the fight or flight response.
And why did they
have? I don't need to evoke the supernatural for this.
Well, it sounds pretty supernatural to me. Your explanation. It just seems like
I tell you what, you go back and learn a little more science, you know, and look at that data, and maybe you'll have a better understanding of what I'm telling you.
I think you're the one who's kind of out on a
limb. Let's back up here. Let me just say something, okay? You know, there is a great unknown. You know, our brains can't know, the world around us completely. That's, of course. You know, there's a tremendous
Our brains can't know
amount.
The world around us?
And, pardon?
You just said our brains can't know the world around us?
They can't know the entire world around us, yeah.
Okay. I just didn't know what you meant by that.
Yeah. I think that's pretty obvious, you know, but I don't think the first leap we make should be, these are extraordinary experiences. They're incredibly important spiritual experiences for these people, and I am not discounting that or dismissing that by any stretch of the imagination.
And you say these are spiritual experiences for the people that have them?
Yeah. Have you ever heard of William James?
Right.
Yeah, I think they would qualify as spiritual experiences by what William James conceived of as spiritual experiences. You know, but what I don't like is people who have little to no firsthand knowledge about how the brain works. You know, trying to explain what the brain is doing during this very complex times. You know, I mean, I guess I should have known where you were coming from when you say we don't understand anything about consciousness. I mean, that is totally untrue. We understand a tremendous amount about consciousness, how the brain makes consciousness. Do we understand everything? Oh, of course not.
Well, that's why I wanted I wanted to take myself out of it when I sent you the quote from, you know, Dr. Jeff Long, who's looked at a lot of near-death experience cases. And
let me ask you, let's back up. Tell me about your publication, you know, your audience, you know.
Well, I think they're scientifically minded folks who are kind of looking at both sides of these controversial subjects like near-death experience, parapsychology, but it's always based on research. And that's, you know, the guy that I spoke to, Dr. Jeff Long, I don't know if you're, you know, familiar with him and his.
Oh, I know Jeff.
By
the way, you know, I think Jeff's a wonderful guy. I mean, he and his wife have done a tremendous job helping the community of people who've had near death and very unusual experiences.
Okay, but I think he understands, you know, what you were just saying, the basic physiology of the brain and what happens, you know, in the quote I sent you. Do you see any problem? Do you have that quote in front of you? I don't want to have to read the whole thing.
I guess rather than really responding to what Jeff is saying.
But that's what it's all about. I think you're in the minority, Dr. Nelson. I mean, he says that it's medically inexplicable for them to have a conscious experience during this time, and that over and over again, that's when people are having near-death experiences. So here's a guy who's looked at it probably as much or more than anyone, and he comes to the same conclusion that I hear over and over and over again from researchers, which is that we really can't deny that this is happening medically. It just happens too often in too many situations. And the second thing they're all saying is that in some way, it seems to be happening at a time that we can't really explain with the understanding we have of brain physiology. So, you know, and then your first comment to me was, well, you're making an extraordinary claim. Back it up. I think the burden of proof has shifted over to your side to say, this is where the data seems to be coming in.
Okay. The question was, can you have experiences that are not brain-based? And what I'm telling you is that what people with near... First off, let me back up. You misunderstood what I was answering. You better go back to your recording. Now, first off, I do believe people are having near-death experiences. I do believe these are probably, I have reason to believe, they're even much more common than people even begin to imagine. Von Lommel, other people like Grayson and Aparna have focused on the cardiac arrest patient. But in fact, I think that's only a small subset of people who have near-death experiences. If you look at an article in The Lancet from Owens, and he looked at the medical records of people who had near-death experience, and only half of them had true medical crisis. That study is frequently forgotten, but it's an astounding study.
What does that study mean
only
to you?
Only half of people with a near-death experience are actually even a medical crisis.
What are your conclusions from
that?
Well, what's your conclusion from that?
My conclusion is that, one, the mind is a very powerful thing, the brain is. Two,
what's your conclusion?
They're looking at the wrong
what's
thing.
What's your conclusion from that research, from that particular research?
My conclusion is that they have failed to fully appreciate that much of what happens with a near-death experience is fight or flight. It's the crisis. It's the way our brain is wired to respond to crisis. Okay, that's number one. Okay, now, let's just go back. So I do believe near-death experiences happen to people. I do believe they're common. I do believe they're spiritually important. But I do also believe there is no scientific evidence that says we have experiences when the brain's dead. Every case I've ever been able to see, and I welcome anybody forwarding me the records, the medical story, the actual medical data, but no one knows when as that EEG is going to flatline, nobody knows when the person has their near-death experience. They just assume it's at the time the EEG is flat, like the Pam Reynolds, case. That's a classic example. But in fact, near-death experience and the experiences that people are having don't necessarily happen when the EEG is flat. There's no reason to suggest that they are. They're probably happening as the EEG is becoming flat.
Okay. That's not the conclusion that most researchers are coming to. And as I've told you in the...
Are they neuroscientists? I'm not sure what researchers you're citing there.
I don't think Grayson and Ken Ring, and I definitely don't think Dr. Peter Fenech, who's been on the show. I mean, of the people who are researching near-death experience, I think that's kind of the minority view. The data seems to be pointing in the other direction. But wait, we're just hashing over the same stuff again and again. Let me go back in the little bit of time that we have, and I appreciate you spending the time and being so open and having this dialogue, debate, whatever you want to call it. It's good. It's great. But go back and touch again on the point that you made again, because when you say that these are spiritual experiences, I really want to probe into that a little bit. I mean, you kind of it's a Williams James kind of experience. What are your patients, the folks who you're interviewing as part of your study, who are having these near-death experiences, what are they telling you, and what are they telling you that's different than they're telling other researchers? Because they say it's not just a quote-unquote spiritual experience. Most people are saying it's a very transformative experience. It's a highly, it's realer than real experience. It's a very significant part of their life. How does that fit into your kind of worldview on this whole thing?
Well, that is what a spiritual experience is. You've just described some of the basic components of a spiritual experience.
I think most people, that spiritual experience, it goes beyond what you're explaining away in terms of the biological explanation for it. So they see it as a lot more things. So just tell me how you see the spiritual experience that your patients, through your researching, how you understand that, and then also about how do you deal with that they don't think it's a dream. They think it's realer than real. What do you make of all that?
First off, I'm not explaining it away. I'm explaining it. Secondly, these are incredibly powerful spiritual experiences that have great personal value. And to some people, they are some of the most important things that ever happened to them. Okay? So I'm not sure what more you want me to say beyond that.
That's probably good. I understand where you're coming from. Do the folks you're talking to, do they agree with your idea of what's going on, that it's just this kind of brain-based, dream-like kind of thing? Because most of the accounts I've read, who have actually had the experience are very much convinced that it's much more than that, that it's much more than a dream, it's much more than something that they've normally encountered with their brain.
Well, many people have many different reactions, but this is typically not the kind of conversation I have with a research subject. It's an inappropriate one, frankly. I can't really answer your question on that.
I think where I was going with that is that in general, the overall data that comes back from the near-death experience is, hey, here's something that seems to pop up a lot throughout time, throughout recorded history, across all these cultures. So it seems to me, this is just personal me, non-scientist speaking here, but that a lot of times we drift away from the experience itself as it's reported by these folks. Why can't we trust more what they're saying, especially in the aggregate, when we take their experience across the range? Isn't that the place where we should start our research into understanding what's really going on, is to listen to the people who are having the experience?
First off, I've never called them dreams. I've never used that word in the scientific interpretation of what they're having. Secondly, I do believe them. In fact, I think that they are remarkably open with some personally extremely important things to them, things that are very, very important to them. But because I believe very firmly in the veracity of what they're telling me, doesn't mean I have to agree with what they see as the underlying cause for their experience. It doesn't follow that. So I just want to emphasize, I think people are being very open and honest. And I think that for a long time, there was many forces that kept people from discussing these unusual experiences. In fact, I've had a lot of people come up to me afterwards and tell me amazing stories that they've never told anyone before because they were concerned about being judged and being judged harshly. So I do believe very firmly that what people are telling me, but that doesn't mean that I have to that I necessarily agree with them on the scientific foundation of what they're experiencing.
Well, Dr. Nelson, what else is coming up for you? Any books on this topic, conferences that you'll be attending?
Yeah, actually, I'll be coming out with a book press sometime next year on explaining the science, what we clearly conventional science tells us about the near-death experience and how they happen, that will be coming out.
Well, thanks for joining us today. Enjoyed the dialogue again.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Well, thanks to Dr. Nelson for joining us today on Skeptico. As I've mentioned over the last couple shows, and many of you responded, please take a minute, visit our website, connect with me, join me on Facebook, join me on Twitter, or just drop me an email. Really love to hear from everybody and really love to try and connect with more of you. So please continue to do that. Also, many of you are blogging about Skeptico and making references to it, and really appreciate that. The more folks we can introduce to this tough discussion on tough questions that really has to happen if we're going to move things forward, well, just the more the merrier. So please encourage you all to do that. There's much more to come on future episodes of Skeptico. Check out our website for more. It's at skeptiko.com. That's going to do it for today. Until next time, bye for now.